Okay, let's get this show on the road, gang.
I'm Batman.
This looks like a job for Superman.
Monthly Mondays, available the third Monday of every month at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com.
Dear Spider-Man fans, and welcome to a very, very special episode of the Spectacular Webs podcast. Of course, I am your host, Thomas Primetime Mattis, and I am here with my PIC partner in crime, Donovan. Donovan, how are you doing tonight?
I am well, and we have a special guest tonight, don't we?
Oh, yes, we do. A good friend of ours, Greg, let me just look up his name just so I can last name so I can make sure I get it right. Bashinsky. And I'm hope I'm saying your name right, because I do want to give you credit. He helped us get in connect with Greg Wiseman, the director and writer on the Spectacular Spider-Man animated series. How are you doing tonight, Greg?
I'm doing great, and it's Bashansky, Greg Bashansky.
There we go. Yeah, he's a friend of the show. You know, he listens to every episode, and he helped us get in contact with you, and we're very thankful for that. So glad to hear you're doing well tonight. So let's just move right into the interview. Our first question is, can you tell us what type of stories influenced you growing up, and have any of those same stories influenced you today as a writer?
I read just tons and tons and then tons more comic books as a kid. I read a lot of detective fiction. I read some fantasy. I read a lot novels, and I was an English major, so I read a lot of literature classics and Greek myths and Norse myths and everything. So all that just is part of the mix, plus lots of TV, way too much TV, and movies and stuff like that. So I'm pretty much a typical geek and pop culture junkie, but I also like to think I've got a pretty deep or relatively deep background in classics and stuff. So I try and be as well read as I can manage, I guess.
Okay, cool. Shakespearean references were obviously had a big part to do with gargoyles. You had the whole Midnight Summer's Dream thing with characters like Puck and such, and they actually found their way into the latter half of the second season of Spectacular Spider-Man. Along those lines, were there anything else that you did or maybe even learned doing when you were doing gargoyles that you used when you were doing Spectacular Spider-Man? Were there anything that you learned from one show that applied to the other?
I'm a Shakespeare fanatic, I guess, to some extent. So, I always am looking for opportunities to throw that in just because it's fun for me. It seemed to make sense in the context of our show where we were at a magnet school where one of the magnets was drama, and that's why Mary Jane was there to do a school play as a runner throughout the thing. It seemed to give us fun stuff, both in terms structurally for our episodes and in terms of creating content for a lot of our supporting cast and creating a crisis for a couple of our characters, Harry and Pete, towards the end of the season. So running that through was fun for me just on my Shakespeare fanboy level, but also really useful, I think, for us, for the series. We used Midsummer Night's Dream, and we had I went back and forth just because Midsummer Night's Dream is so obvious. I was thinking, is there a better choice for our play? what it came down to is just, having the character of Cobweb and the character Robin, Puck, who is referred to as Goblin or Hobgoblin also in the play. It was just sort of like, it's just too perfect, and it gave us this great stuff with Flash with the donkey mask and everything. It just, I kept trying to figure out if there was another play that would be better because Midsummer was so, the obvious one to do, and it just kept coming back to, well, it's the obvious one to do because it just fits our show so well. So we just went with that, and I think it worked out great. And we had the whole running gag of Hobie not speaking throughout the last half dozen or so episodes leading up to, in season one, Hobie appears a few times, but we weren't you know, we just didn't have anything for him to say. It wasn't like that was a plan. But in season two, it was a plan, you know, obviously. You know, it became this running gag. So to me, the idea that the first time you actually hear his voice is him reading Shakespeare, I just thought was terrific. So I mean, I don't know if it is terrific, but I liked it. So in any event, it was just a lot of fun for us. So.
Real quick, he was obviously dressed up as his Midnight Summer's Dream character and as the Goblin. Was it also like happy accident that the green and purple kind of matched to his Prowler identity? Or was that just kind of like, hey, look at that?
I'm sorry, I just didn't hear you.
I'm sorry. And when he first started speaking, you know, he was dressed up in the play that in colors that correlated to the Green Goblin. Was it a happy accident that he also, those colors were also the colors of his Prowler identity, you know, the green and the purple?
Well, you could call it a happy accident. You could call the fact that 90% of Spider-Man's villains were green and or purple. I mean, and the main reason for that, I'm sure back in the day, was pragmatic. You know, I mean, you've got a blue and red hero. He's very, you know, primary color heroes. And, you know, visually what works with to put against blue and red, you don't want a blue and red villain, you know, because it just, you know, in the days of color seps and relatively crude coloring that existed in the 60s and 70s, you know, and for that matter into the 80s, you know, it helped to have contrasting color schemes. And so when your hero's blue and red, your villains tend to be green and purple. What that meant for us, and this was a very conscious choice on Vic Cook's part, my partner Vic Cook, was that green for us was the color of evil. I mean, and we use that throughout. So, for example, because Pete was tormented by the football team, Midtown High's colors were green and white. You know, so that when the football team, all the way back to episode one, is you know, that first high school scene where, to a lesser extent, Rand, but certainly Flash and Kenny are tormenting Pete. They're wearing, you know, green varsity jackets. And because from Vic's point of view, which I thought was genius, green was the color of evil for us as a, you know, on an ongoing sort of motif basis.
And I'm sure every kid can identify with green being the color of evil, you know, lettuce, vegetables.
Right.
Sorry, couldn't help it. But a quick follow-up to the Shakespeare question Don just asked. What is your favorite Shakespearean play?
I don't know that I have one favorite. I'm, you know, there's just a bunch that I have that grab me for lots of different reasons. Sometimes it's, you know, because I have a take on it. There's something I'd like to do with it. Sometimes it just really reaches me. I mean, when I was a kid, I hated Romeo and Juliet. My daughter, who's 15, thinks Romeo and Juliet's awful. I remember as a kid not liking it just because the Romeo and Juliet both seemed, I mean, I have a clear memory of this, that they just seemed like such morons. Like, if they'd just been a little smarter, blah, 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 then, you know, the tragedy wouldn't have happened. And then the older I got, the more sympathetic I was towards them. I love Romeo and Juliet now. Love it. My favorite Shakespearean character of all time is probably Edmund the Bastard from King Lear. I mean, he's probably the one character that I think is just, I just can't get enough of. But I don't have a single play. There's probably, you know, out of the canon of 30 plus plays, you know, there are very few that I don't like. I mean, there are probably none that I don't like entirely, but there are very few that I wouldn't run out to see at any opportunity. You know, and even those, you know, you get a good production going and they can still kind of wow you. some are clearly, you know, stronger than others, but I'm a huge just Shakespeare geek, so I like pretty much like them all.
Yes. Well, for our second question, just to go on something that I probably should have said before that, of course, you have worked previously on other shows. You know, you did the Bible for Max Steel, which that's something I recently learned, which is actually one of my favorite shows growing up. I actually very much enjoyed Max Steel. And you also worked on the second season of Witch, which I thought was a very underappreciated show, actually. Only got it had two seasons, but, you know, it was a very good show in my mind. So, you had Gargoyles and the second season of Witch and Max Steel and all that. And then you come to Spider-Man. So, what was the decision to air the new Spider-Man cartoon when it did? Was it specific to the success of the movie franchise and the large box office draw of the third movie made, or was it more of a proposal that Marvel Entertainment made to Sony?
Well, you know, I can't answer, not because I'm forbidden, I just don't know what exactly all the business stuff that went into them calling me and saying, hey, do you want to do this? You know, in terms of the timing of it and everything, I'm sure, you know, they had done a Spider-Man series for MTV that I had not seen. I'd worked on briefly, and then they switched story editors. And when the new story came on, I'd written one outline, and I understand this. It's just, you know, the new guy was like, I don't want to do this. Let me do my own stuff with my own writers. So, you know, it wasn't, I didn't end up working on the MTV Spider-Man show at all. Let me rephrase it. I did work on it, but nothing that I did made it on the air at all.
Clearly you didn't.
And I didn't watch it. So I don't know, you know, I've heard good things about it. I've heard bad things about it. I got no opinion. Because there was just no good reason for me to watch it. If I watched it and thought it was great, I'd be jealous as hell that I wasn't involved in it. And if I watched it and it was awful, then I'd just be like, just sort of like, you know, it would have been so much better if they had kept us on it, you know, kind of thing. So there was just, you know, no, I take that approach in that if there's no good news, I'm just not going to tune in. I'm a shallow enough person to admit that. But for whatever reason, it was perceived as a failure of sorts, which on one level is kind of surprising because I know the ratings were good. But MTV, Sony, Marvel, no one was happy with it. I'm not exactly clear why. I know a lot of good people did end up working on it, but they just weren't that happy with it. And so, and that one was designed to, I think they were hamstrung on that, you know, because it was designed to literally be a sequel to the first movie and a prequel to the second movie. So, for example, I know a guy who worked on a Doc Ock episode for it, and they had to throw it away. It was good. You know, I read the script. It was a great script, but they had to throw it away because after the script was written, they realized that Doc Ock was going to be the villain in the second movie, and he was going to be introduced in the second movie. So, obviously, you couldn't introduce him in a cartoon that was in continuity with the movies and came in between movie one and movie two. And so they were really kind of trapped, I think. So one of the things, one of the decisions that happened early on, which I was very grateful for, was that we weren't in continuity with any of the movies. Even though, you know, we were appearing, I guess, after the third movie came out. We were in production in between the second and the third movie, and then between the third and what wound up not being, you know, getting canceled for the fourth. Either way, it didn't some extent didn't matter because we weren't going to be in continuity with these movies. And that was a huge relief, that we were being given the freedom to really start from scratch. But obviously, the movie, the fact of the movies was a one of the reasons they wanted to do the show, both from a Sony, I'm sure, from a Marvel standpoint. There was no network when I started. We didn't know where we were going to be airing yet. So it wasn't that issue at all. I've gotten a little far afield of the original question, but my point is that I don't really have the inside information on that. What I know is that they interviewed me a couple times for the job, I want to say, in February or March of 2006. Does that make sense? And then I knew they were talking to a couple other people, and I just didn't hear anything for months. I mean, like, you know, then I was at a Christmas party, you know, in December of that same year. After 11 months, you're pretty confident you didn't get the gig, you know. I mean, they don't get back to you after 11 months. I was pretty sure someone else had, you know, they'd given it to someone else or decided not to do the show or something. And I was at a Christmas party, and some guy comes up to me and congratulates me on getting the Spider-Man gig. And I was like, no, I didn't get it. I think they gave it to such and such or whatever. And they're like, no, they called me and said, you know, it was you. And I said, who called you? When did they call you? And they're like, well, called me Friday. This last Friday? This, you know, this is a weekend. I'm like, you know, what are you talking about? So Monday I call my agent. I'm like, what's going on? And he doesn't know anything about it. But then, you know, I get a phone call from Marvel and Sony in quick succession. They all want to meet with me. Totally caught me off guard, you know. And they're like, come in, you know. And Marvel set up a meeting with me, and then Sony wanted to make sure they met with me before Marvel did. And so they're like, come over now. Because the meeting with Marvel was the next day. They're like, come over now. And I'm sitting there in my office, like in a T-shirt, and I hadn't shaved that day. And I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to make the best impression. And they're like, no, come over. We need to talk to you now. So I came in and you know, we just had two great meetings, one with Sony and then one with Marvel in a row. I said, well, here's what I do. You know, I say, you know, he should be in high school. You know, we should be doing this as if this is first time. I had the notion that, you know, he became Spider-Man, you know, a few months before, and he'd had the summer, but he'd never faced any supervillains. So although we wouldn't be doing his origin over right away, I said, let's wait, you know, a bunch of weeks. We will do his origin eventually, but we'll tell it after the audience is invested in who Peter is, so they give a damn about it, and it's not sort of pro forma, like, oh yeah, we have to give the origin because it's Spider-Man. I'm like, look, most of the audience has seen the movies, so they'll know the origin, and for those who don't, let's make it mean something. And I said, you know, let's play this guy like a 16-year-old kid. I said, you know, one of the things I said day one is that this is a guy who is madly, passionately in love with whatever girl happens to be standing in front of him at any given moment. And that he'll evolve from there, but really play this guy as a work in progress. And the notion that the theme of the show would be the education of Peter Parker, that was in there right from the beginning. And like I said, we just did two consecutive days, one with Sony and then one with Sony and Marvel on the second day, had a couple great meetings. And I still didn't know if I had the job, you know. And then, you know, a couple days later, it's like, yeah, it's yours if you want it. I'm like, are you kidding me? Of course, you know. It's like a dream come true kind of thing. And so then that December, I actually was leaving for a family vacation, and I just went out and bought, you know, the first six volumes of Essential Spider-Man. You know, the black and white phone book volumes.
The one you can kill a guy with? Yeah.
The ones I have, yeah.
You know, and it's not like I hadn't read all these stories before. Of course I had, but I, you know, went through them, took copious notes on every character. And basically while I was on vacation in Arizona, beat out more or less the whole first season, you know, not in tremendous detail, but just like, we'll do Vulture first, we'll do, you know, and got it all sort of laid out. Here's our season, you know, tried to intertwine things and make sense how the characters were introduced and came back and pitched in. I'm not saying nothing changed from there, but fundamentally it mostly stayed the same. I mean, we had a few minor changes. I think we moved Electro up to episode 2 and he'd been a little bit later, and we moved Craven back to season 2 because Marvel felt fairly strongly that Spider-Man had to make enough of a name for himself to attract Craven's attention in the first place. So it was, he'd be a better intro in season 2, which made sense to me, you know.
Very interesting.
Yeah. And but you know, the basic breakdown of it, you know, we had this whole, hey, I wanted to find a way to recreate the great mystery that Stan and Steve and John Sr. did over who's the identity of the Green Goblin. And so one of our big challenges was like, how do we create a mystery about something that everybody knows? You know, how do we manage to do that? And that was a challenge we sort of set for ourselves. But it seemed to me the mystery of who is the Green Goblin was so inherent to the fascination with the character that we had to find a way to build that mystery again, not just for people who had never heard of Green, you know, kids who had never seen Green Goblin before, but also for try and see if we could misdirect even the hardcore fans into wondering what we were up to.
Mission accomplished.
Good. I mean, I'm glad. You know, you always worry. Yeah. You always worry about whether, you know, it's working. But that was the plan, kind of from moment one. You know, we've got, and you know, part of it was we're going to take this big risk on Green Goblin because we're going to end season one, and if we don't get a season two, we're kind of jerks. You know what I mean? you know, because we'll never be able to reveal what the real truth was. But you know, if we crossed our fingers that the show would be good enough that we'd get a season two and we'd be able to you know, really twist everyone's heads around 180. I mean, we felt we'd sort of done that in season one. We wanted to be able to do that in season two, but really sort of bring it back to where we felt it needed to go.
Okay. Well, how were you approached on executive producing the show? And did this happen? Yeah, in supervising, did this happen to concur with you writing the scripts for the Batman television show that was airing at the same time?
I mean, you mean when I was originally approached, like I said, 11 months earlier. Or when they finally gave me the job.
I'm trying to think because I clearly remember the show premiering while the Batman was in its final season, and I, you know, I don't think you were a staff writer, but you had written scripts for that show. So I was wondering if you had we were both wondering if you were juggling two jobs at the same time.
No, I really wasn't. Not on that. I had freelance Batman across all five seasons of the Batman. You know, I wrote a few for season one, and then probably missed a couple seasons while I was doing Witch, and then came back and wrote a few for seasons, I think, 3 and 4 or something. I remember the episodes I wrote. I don't remember exactly which season they were for, but that was all freelance stuff that I think I did between producing other shows, like between producing Witch and Spider-Man or that kind of thing. I don't know whether the guys over at Sony, I can't say whether how aware they were of what I had done on the Batman. I know that my boss at Sony, Michael Vogel, had been a Gargoyles fan, so I'm sure that it had something to do with it. But part of it was just, you know, I guess I gave good meeting. You know, I came in and I said, here's what I'd like to do with Spider-Man. Here's what I think you guys should do. And they liked what I had to say. And I have the credits, I guess, to back it up, at least to some extent. But so it's not like, oh, he talks a good game, but can he produce a show? The answer is, well, he's done it before, and look at the good shows he's done, you know. And I'd worked for Sony before because I did Starship Troopers. I was a story editor on Starship Troopers. I was a story editor slash producer on Max Steel. And I was, you know, writer on Men in Black. And so, you know, I'd done enough work for Sony that they knew my stuff. And I had the credits and I had the idea for Spidey that they liked. So it just all sort of came together. And I think initially... I mean, the funny piece is that I think it was Vic Cook who told me, again, way back when, that they were thinking about doing a new Spider-Man show, and it was like, you should go talk to them about it. So I talked to Grace Benn and Michael Vogel about the show, talked to their bosses about the show, and then, like I said, didn't get a call back for 11 months and figured that they had just gone with someone else. And, you know, I think they did go with someone else and then for whatever reason changed their minds or it didn't work out. I don't know what, I really don't know what the details were. But you know, eventually they came back to me, thank God. And then of course they're like, well, who do you want to work with on this? And I'm like, Vic Cook. And it wasn't just like a payback as he had told me about in the first place. It's, you know, Vic and I have worked together many times before and he was just a great choice for doing the show with me. So, you know, it was a really great partnership. And I think in some very theoretical sense, I was his boss during season one, but it was really a partnership from day one. And then we made that official in season two that we were just equal partners in credit also on season two. But the show is really a joint effort between the two of us and, of course, between all the directors and actors and artists and writers and stuff. You know, it was a huge collaborative process and lots of people involved.
Yeah. Now we know the process that it took to get Josh Keaton as the voice of Spider-Man. We heard the stories where you had literally tried out like 2,000 people for both separately Peter Parker and Spider-Man, and
no,
you felt
it
that
was,
Josh.
It was.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It was 2,000 people. I'm not sure if it was that much, but it was probably some like 1,500 people across 11 parts. It wasn't that much just for Peter Parker, Spider-Man. It was for all 11 of the people we were casting, which is still a lot to listen to. probably had a few hundred Peter Parker slash Spider-Mans in there, but it wasn't thousands of Spider-Men. I mean, it was enough. It was painful enough just with what we did have. I don't want to overplay it. But, yeah, we had initial auditions and then, which were all cold. You know, we weren't involved with them. We sent the copy out and the agent sent back all these guys. And then we called back a few people and then we had second callbacks. And then, you know, we had this big casting meeting and, you know, I was kind of nervous about it. Jamie Thomas and our voice director and I sort of talked before the meeting and we went into the meeting and I'll be honest, I kind of had a chip on my shoulder. I was ready for this big fight, you know, saying, on all the characters, actually, not just Spider-Man. So, you know, the meeting began and they're like, well, Greg, who's your first choice for, Peter Parker, Spider-Man? And I was like, Josh Keaton, you know, with my fists up ready to, I mean, not literally, but, you know, with this ready to fight for it kind of thing. And they're like, oh yeah, Josh was our first choice too. And I'm like, you know, it's one of those sitcom moments where you're so ready for the battle that it takes you a second to realize that they just said yes to you. So you have to sort of go, great. That's terrific. You know, I mean, you know, kind of moment where, you just, you know, completely have to reset your thinking. And then it was like that for every single character. I mean, I think, you know, I think there was one instance where they preferred my second choice to my first choice for one of those characters, but I got why they were felt that way, and I was fine with it, you know. But there was just no argument on anything. You know, I came into the meeting thinking it was going to be this big fight for every single character, and it wound up being literally no fight whatsoever on any character. we had this phenomenal cast, and we were all in agreement on it from moment one. And it was a big range, I mean, from voice guys to, you know, live-action people to, you know, like Deborah Strang, who I thought was just amazing as Aunt May. You know, she's done some live-action stuff, but I don't think she had ever done any cartoons before, and I found her because I saw her in Romeo and Juliet playing the nurse at a local theater production at A Noise Within in Glendale. And I'd seen her in many plays before that, but specifically I'm watching this play while I'm thinking about Spider-Man, you know, just because, you know, you bring your job with you everywhere you go. And I'm listening to her play the nurse, and I for a second I like close my eyes and listen to it and go, wow, that would be perfect for Aunt May. And I don't want to take credit for it because all I did was say, make sure she auditions. After that, you know, she could have done a lousy job. 100 things could have gone wrong with the idea of getting her in the role. But like I said, you know, when it was like, who for Aunt May? They're like, I'm like, well, my first choice is Deborah Strang. And everyone's like, yeah, we thought she was best too. So, I mean, she won the role for herself. But it was, you know, it was the cast was this big range of people. I mean, the cast wound up being huge because we had so many characters.
Yeah, I think me and Don actually today. Don's the one who found it, but apparently you did. I think last year you did a big crossover audio event between Gargoyles and Spectacular Spider-Man and
Religious Studies 101.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. We saw those YouTube clips and we're like, we're both left in awe, and we both definitely wanted to know if we could find more of that audio
the whole
recording
thing's on YouTube. The entire play on YouTube.
Well, well, is it probably going to be under the name of Religious Studies?
No, I think it's just, I think, I have to check, but I think it's sort of like under, hold on. I think it's under like Gargoyles Radio Play 2009, and then there's 7 parts plus the credits.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, we were literally reading the script today that we found online. It's like, this is amazing.
Well, I mean, I think the thing that strikes me as amazing about that, what is that I had to write it in 3 days. and the reason it worked out as well as it did was, A, because I just had this phenomenal cast. I mean, we had tons of the real performers from both Gargoyles and Spectacular Spider-Man show up to the convention and play their parts and then filled out the rest with very talented fans who came in and read. And then part of it is just that I really knew the audience we were playing to and could pander shamelessly to them. So, I mean,
Yeah, definitely the script where Green Goblin makes a mention about where can I get Gargoyles. I'll call Walt Disney.
Yeah, I mean, so it's stuff like that. I mean, it wasn't even subtle. I mean, I wasn't trying to be subtle, even vaguely, so I'm not ashamed about it. It just, you know, that was the gag. So, but we had a lot of fun. It was a great performance, and it was cool because, you know, I was able to say sort of from the beginning, you know, if you guys like this, then I'm a genius. And if you don't like it, it's because I only had 3 days to do it, and it's not my fault.
How you do it?
Yeah, that is how you do it. But what were the parameters?
Parameters.
In airing this show, with as much violence, I mean, there were some like, not brutal, but very heavy fight scenes in the show for the Spectacular Spider-Man set with broadcast standards and practices?
Well, we got pretty lucky. I mean, you know, any show that I've worked on, I think you find you're trying to get away with stuff here and there, see what you're pushing the envelope. I mean, not to push it so much, but just to figure out, okay, what are the parameters? And you're not sure, you know, because every network's different, and not only is every network different, but, you know, network personnel changes over time. So, you know, what might have been true at Kids WB and, you know, the last time I did a show for Kids WB might not be true for Kids WB now if there's a different person in charge of S&P, you know.
Yeah.
So we had, I think, particularly at Kids WB, just this great S&P executive who got it, who got the show and understood that as long as we were showing repercussions of things, you know, that we didn't make it too easy, you know, that we were kind of allowed to do what we wanted on it. She would look at the scripts and she would look at the boards, and she was really great about it. And so in the end, the biggest issue became about the sound, realistic sound effects of gunshots. You know, so you put a little bit of harmonize on those gunshot sounds so they sound just a little bit laser-esque, and we were okay. Mm-hmm. You know, that became the biggest problem we had, and when you push comes to shove, that wasn't really that big a deal to us.
That's amazing to find out, because especially when it comes to episode 10 with Black Cat, I know we're talking about violence, but also some of the there was a lot of sexual interlude in that episode, and like I'm thinking, wow, they really got away with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the tricks to it of doing sexual innuendo is the double entendre, and one of the tricks to that is that it's actually got to be double entendre. I mean, I think what people mess up is that there's no double, you know, in other words, it's just all entendre, you know, in other words, there's no, they put a line and they're like, oh, it's double entendre, except there's no innocent interpretation of it, you know what I mean? I mean, the raunchiest line in the entire two seasons of Spider-Man is the moment when Black Cat says something, I may not have the quote exactly, but it's something along the lines of, don't you get your goop in my hair.
Don't worry, it washes out with water and peanut butter.
Ice or peanut butter, yeah. But, you know, and that one line of hers, particularly with Trisha Helfer's incredibly sexy voice saying it, is incredibly dirty. But if you're a kid and you've just seen Spider-Man fire off his webbing, you know exactly what she's referring to. It goes over the kid's head because the innuendo goes over the head completely because they've got an interpretation that totally works for them on a basic level. Whereas the, you know, the sort of sexy thing, that wouldn't even cross their minds because they don't know about it. And that, to me, is the trick to doing the double entendre. And where I see people go, well, I couldn't get that across. And I look at Vaughn, I'm like, well, because there was no double, you know. The only interpretation of that line is dirty. It's the only interpretation, you know. And so one of the things we learned is that you can do a lot more when you're just being smart, you know, as opposed to trying to be dirty. You'd be smart about it. And so we wound up getting away with a lot more. Now, again, I mean, part of the reason so many of those lines in that Black Cat episode, actually both our Black Cat episodes, are so sexy just comes down to, you know, Trisha.
Yes, we talked in, I think both me and Don talked in length about her sexy voice, didn't we, Don?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Keeping on the topic of censorship and broadcast standards and practices, you know, this is not your first show, Were there any differentiating experiences with the censors, like from when you were doing Gargoyles to doing Witch to doing Spectacular Spider-Man? Did you find that they were more lenient? Were they different shows with different censor groups, or were they all basically the same? Do you think you talk about that?
Well, so much has to do with who is your S&P executive. So the thing that Gargoyles and Spider-Man had in common, although they're two different people, is that we just had, on both those shows, S&P executives who really got it, you know, who understood what we were trying to do, the stories we were trying to tell. We had an advantage at Gargoyles that we weren't a network show. We were a syndicated show. And so there was no network S&P person. We had someone that, for our syndicated shows, that, you know, in essence, particularly season one when I was still a development executive, worked for me. And even on season two when I moved over full-time to produce Gargoyles, her name was Adrienne Bello. She was just terrific. She understood. She got it, you know, that this was about consequences. This was about, cause and effect. And let us not get away with stuff, because we weren't trying to get away with stuff. It was about, you know, letting us be smart and tell smart stories that didn't pander. And she was just terrific. So, different times on different other shows I've worked on, it hasn't always been, you know, sometimes you get people where the executives are on the show are either less accommodating or more nervous or more afraid that, of the letters they might receive or something like that. And, on those two shows specifically, we just had great executives. I mean, I just can't give them enough credit for, you know, being there and helping us out.
Yeah. On our podcast, the first aspect of each episode we try to review is the music and the soundtrack to each episode. We specifically pay attention towards any character themes or action sequences. Can you talk about the decision to go with the theme song that is now the classic Spectacular Spider-Man theme?
Well, the theme song, we auditioned people. I mean, we had a bunch of people submit sample theme songs. I wrote some lyrics, which we, I guess, I wrote a little too late. Like, most of the people had got the assignment before my lyrics were done. So only one guy tried to use my lyrics, and unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, he was kind of not great. We didn't wind up going with my lyrics, but, you know, we actually found three or four songs that we really loved, and our hope had been that for the DVDs we'd actually be able to use all four songs. But I think there was just this consensus that what Tenderbox did for Spectacular Spider-Man was just so catchy and so great that, both lyrically and musically, that this was perfect for the show. I mean, our original plan had been, hey, let's do a modern version of the 1960s Spider-Man cartoon song. I mean, let's take that song but just do an updated version of it. And we found that it was prohibitively expensive to use that song. So we couldn't, but we wanted something that had that kind of energy to it, so that it was one of our notes. And Tenderbox just gave us that. There were three other great songs, I mean, just great, that we would have loved to have used. And again, when it came time to do the DVDs, they just decided not to spend the money to do those other songs, which we thought was too bad, because we really wanted to integrate them in and be able to use all four songs at some point. But I don't think there was, again, it was one of these things where there wasn't much argument that in terms of what was our theme song, that Tenderbox song was the one. They just did a fantastic job. And I never actually met those guys. I mean, you know, I heard their music and it was terrific and everything, but I, you know, I never actually met them in person. But they did a great job. And our composers, you know, for the series were Dynamic Music Partners, who just did a fantastic job for all the rest of the music.
Yeah, I believe they worked on Justice League and Justice League Unlimited. If I'm,
it was Michael Christian, Lolita Ritmanis. That is them, right? Or we?
Yeah, Chris Carter, Michael McQuistion, and Lolita Ritmanis. That's it.
Yes.
Those are the three Dynamic Music Partners, and they did just a stellar job. I mean, on so much diverse, different stuff. You know, we did a Christmas episode where they're doing, you know, takes on Christmas music. They've got to do Muzak in elevators. They've got to do sorts of different stuff for the show. We wanted recurring musical themes for romance. We wanted each villain to have a recurring musical theme and even an instrument that sort of would, if the instrument started to play, you'd sort of think, oh, that's, you know, it would make you subconsciously think of such and such a villain, you know, kind of thing. We asked a lot of them and they just really, really delivered for us. It was great.
Okay. As a personal aside, what are some of your favorite themes in the show? Like, are there any like character themes that specifically you kind of like, or are there any kind of moments in the episodes that you did where you thought the music was really, you personally liked them? What were some of your favorite themes from the show?
You know, I'm not the best at this only because I see 26 episodes as like 26 of my kids, and I'm not too good at saying, hey, that I love this kid and I don't love this kid as much. it's just not the way my brain works, really. But, you know, musically, I liked what they did on the New Year's Eve thing. Some of the action stuff is great. You know, some of the Christmas stuff I thought worked out great. We had this opera episode, and at one point, and you know what was so hard for DMP on that one is that, you know, we're using opera that Sony has, you know, rights to. So we've got these sequences that we can use in essence for free because it's part of Sony's library, but it only covers a small portion of the episode. And yet the whole episode is except for the teaser and the very end of the tag at the beginning and end of the episode, the entire episode we decided early on is going to be source music. So it's the jazz combo at the club where the teenagers are having their Valentine's Day dinner, or it's the opera at the opera house, or it's, you know, a radio in the background where Aunt May and Doc are having their little tete-a-tete. You know, we decided, or the music in the lobby, that everything from the beginning of Act One until nearly the very end of the episode would have to be source music. And yes, we had these opera clips that we could use, but they had to, it wasn't even enough opera to fill out the whole episode, so they had to match up to what was doing on the opera and then have all these other beats on it, and just the work they did on that episode, part of which was editing as opposed to composing, but just making it all flow was terrific. And then we had this idea at the mix to cut out all dialogue and sound effects at the very end of the Tombstone Spider-Man battle and just let the opera music carry it through to the end of the fight. And so that was my idea, but then someone, I think Michael Vogel, had the idea that we needed to get out of the sound effects. So there's this one moment where it's pretty subtle, I think it works really well, which is where I think Tombstone slams a pipe against another, you know, misses Spider-Man's head, and a pipe sort of rings out across another when it hits this other pipe. And that's like the last sound effect you hear, that ringing out of the pipe. And from there on, it's just all music. And frankly, it took a sequence where the animation maybe wasn't some of the strongest animation that we had gotten, and yet had to be incredibly strong because this was this fight that we'd been building to since episode 6. And just actually made that sequence. It was the music that saved that sequence. I mean, I'm not saying the animation was awful. It wasn't, but it wasn't the strongest animation we had received. And so mm-hmm. what really made that work was the music. So, you know, that's a big favorite of mine, I think.
And we will be right back to the Spectacular Web's interview with Greg Wiseman after these important messages.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, a great adventure took place.
I'm going to regret this.
This is ridiculous.
Don't be alarmed. It's only a laser sword fight.
Star Tours announces the boarding of the Endor Express, non-stop star speeder service to the moon of Endor. All passengers, please prepare for immediate boarding.
No! Can I get your ship out?
Lando Calrissian is a positive role model in the realm of science fiction fans.
F*** Lando Calrissian.
Star Wars Monthly Mondays, available the first Monday of every month at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com.
We would be honored if you would join us.
And we're back to the Spectacular Web's interview with Greg Wiseman. Well, we're going to start moving into characters from here. Probably my fault. You're giving us a lot, and we're very thankful. But your creative teammate Gwen Stacy in the start of the show out from a timid introvert who hid her feelings from Peter into more of a blossoming beauty that was akin to the Steve Ditko and John Romita design transitions from the original comics in the 60s. What led to going down that road for the character?
Well, I think the main thing was that we felt... that, you know, we were very consciously pulling in characters from a lot of different eras. I mean, you know, obviously we wanted all those great Lee Ditko characters, including Flash and Liz Allen, and then we wanted these great Lee Romita characters like Gwen and Harry and MJ, and then, you know, we were even going further than that and pulling in Eddie Brock and all sorts of guys from way later in the continuity, and we were pretty shameless about it. I'm not going to pretend otherwise, but, you know, one of the things that we decided early on was that, okay, we all know what Harry was like in college. We read those comics, but we're not meeting him in college. What if we were meeting him in high school? We all know what MJ was like in college, but what if we met her a few years before that, and likewise, what if we met Gwen a few years before that? And so, you know, we tried to do a couple things. You know, one of them was that Gwen was always the smart science girl. She was in college. She was the hot as hell smart science girl. but she was, you know, the one who took all of Peter's, the same classes Peter took. And Peter was the sort of transcendent genius who was still never that great because he was always ditching out to be Spider-Man, but still he was always the really brilliant guy. But Gwen kept up with him class for class. She was always in his science classes. And Harry was the one who was always sort of failing.
Yeah.
You know, those classes. So we're like, well, all right, yeah, we could just have her be the hot blonde in high school too, but is that really all that interesting? Doesn't it make more sense if you're the geeky, nerdy science girl that, you know, not everybody blossoms in high school. Some people blossom later. And because we wanted to create contrast between Mary Jane and Gwen, and contrast between Liz Allen and Gwen, and contrast between all these different ladies. You know, we were going to play, like I said, a Peter Parker who could be easily distracted and easily infatuated with whatever girl happened to be in front of him. We wanted to have a diversity in our female lineup, so to speak, and yet we knew we wanted to have that face it, Tiger, you just hit the jackpot moment with Mary Jane. It was like, well, all right, if Mary Jane's going to be hot all the way back to high school, maybe Gwen isn't. And so it was about extrapolating backwards for some of these characters who we knew in college, but all right, what were they like back in high school? If we actually met them 3 or 4 years earlier, what would we have thought of them then? And try and do that. So the decision to make Gwen a little bit of a female Peter Parker, that is the Peter Parker pre-Spider-Man Peter Parker, was kind of a no-brainer to provide this contrast and try and create a Gwen who you just had to fall in love with, that you couldn't not love, that you totally get why, you know, it would be his first great love. And there were other adjustments, too. I mean, for me, because I'm so f***ing old, can I say something? You may have to bleep me. But anyway, I'm so f***ing old, you know, I don't forget Betty Brant, you know, because I grew up, Betty Brant was his first girlfriend. And now you look at it and you go, okay, the girl who is working as J. Jonah Jameson's assistant, you know, and I'm trying to go back and look at the clues and go, okay, so what is the deal here? Is the deal that, you know, and this was possible back in the 60s, that a girl would drop out of high school and be 16 or 17 years old but be working for, you know, have dropped out of high school but be working as a secretary. Was that the idea, or was the idea that, no, she was a few years older than Peter, you know, she was out of high school, and ultimately we decided to go that route, which is that, you know, okay, she's, you know, 20, out of high school, you know, didn't go to college, became an assistant, and, you know, became Jonah's assistant because she's the one who could take him, you know. My thinking is that Jonah used to go through assistants every 2 days, you know, until you know, she came out of the temp pool or the steno pool or whatever, however you want to call it, in 2008, and she could take him, you know.
She could take his, right?
She could take his baloney, and she could take his pomposity, and she could tank his temper tantrums and deal. And that Jonah, for all his Jonah-ness, recognizes talent and was smart enough to realize, all right, I got to hold on to this one. And and so she winds up sticking with it. But what that means is that if she's 20 years old and the 16-year-old guy's hitting on her, it may wear her down because he is kind of funny and he is kind of cute and this kind of thing. And so maybe, all right, God, I'm not going to your prom, all right? I'm not a high school kid. I'm not going to your prom. All right, I'll think about it until Aunt May sort of says, you're just too old for him, dear. And then she
But I like to refer as the cock block of the year, but that's besides the point.
But now you got to bleep you.
Yeah. Well, we actually said that on the air, too. So, and it did get the anger, so... But our personal opinion on the Spec Webs podcast is that this iteration of Gwen Stacy is a vast improvement over the 1960s Marvel Comics girlfriend archetype that Gwen was from the comics embodied in the original issues. To this day, many fans see her as Peter Parker's true love interest, despite there being actual reasoning for that being so outside the fact that they were together when she died. In Spectacular Spider-Man, the show's representation of Gwen in high school vastly differed from her in college. Is this a wholly unique interpretation of the character, or do you think this is how she would have been at the age of 16 if Stan and Steve had her in Peter's original supporting cast?
Well, you know, I don't want to be presumptuous vis-a-vis, you know, Stanley, Steve Ditko. I don't want to sit here and say, oh, yeah, that's how they would have done it, the way I did it. That sounds too obnoxious. for words, frankly. But you know, what I will say is that I tried my best to use their Gwen as a starting point for both, again, extrapolating backwards and extrapolating forwards. I mean, you know, again, if Gwen is like this here, if we want to contrast her with Mary Jane, where are we going to where are we going to find her at age 16? You know, our guiding thing on the series as a whole, not just with Gwen, but with everything, was always Stan Steven and Jazzy Johnny. You know, I mean, it that was where we went to first for everything. You know, we borrowed stuff from Ultimate Spider-Man, we borrowed stuff from the movies, we borrowed stuff from Untold Tales of Spider-Man, we borrowed from all over the place, you know, and shamelessly, again, you know, that was our source material. But fundamentally, you know, it was the Lee Ditko, Lee Romita stuff that was our Bible. So I don't want to be presumptuous about that's what they would have done. It's more like, hey, we were inspired by them, not the other way around. And, you know, what I know about Gwen Stacy is this was the first great love of Peter Parker's life. And for that to be true, for it not to just be another Liz Allen or another Betty Brant, that is someone he dated or was interested in for a while, but someone who he loved desperately and would have married had things worked out differently, you had to love Gwen. Just like later, you have to learn to, you know, you have to love MJ. She can't ultimately just be a party girl and nothing else. You know, you have to go deeper than that. And so we tried to create a Gwen, I'm going to say this very consciously, and this includes, you know, the tremendous work of Lacey Chabert playing Gwen.
Oh, yeah.
You have to create a Gwen that not just Peter, but that Peter, in fact, is behind the audience. You know, if we're doing our job right, the audience falls in love with Gwen before Peter even figures out that that's who he's in love with. That Venom... God, I did it again. The Venom figures it out. Venom figures it out before Peter does. Venom figures out that Peter's in love with Gwen before Peter figures out that Peter's in love with Gwen. You know, that this is the person that he's got the deepest connection to at this stage in his life. And that was, I don't want to make it sound calculating, because, like, well, that's what we had to do to make it was just, because it goes beyond calculation, it's just essential. If we don't do that, then we've blown it, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, there just wasn't any choice in the matter. We had to make that work, or else we'd have failed. You know, if it works for you guys, I'm thrilled, because that was just essential to what we needed to do for the character.
I think it's essential that for a lot of the female characters, not just Gwen, but pretty much all of them, they were very much strong female leads. And I know for me, that's very important for the female leads not to be just the typical archetype love interest. I want them to have something more to them. So I know that's what drew me to it, and I know what I'm sure Don can say what drew him to it. But I think Don's going to take the next question about Liz Allen, because I have to, or it'll hurt me.
I'm a fan of Liz, what y'all did with Liz on the show. You know, she's a longtime Spidey character. What I found interesting was that it seems that her arc in the Spectacular Spider-Man cartoon was basically her being attracted to men who either didn't share their attraction with her or were into something else entirely. Like, you know, she was first with Flash, and then Flash started seeing Mary Jane. Then she went with Peter, and then Peter was seeing Gwen. And it just seemed like sort of like this vicious cycle. Conversely, it was sort of what was going on with Peter and Harry with Liz in the comic book. So I was wondering if this idea that Liz was always attracted to people who didn't, you know, give her attraction back. I was wondering if that was something intentionally done, or how y'all saw that, took it from the comics and put it in the show.
It's not really how I saw it. I mean, I'm loath to sort of say, hey, that's, if that's what you found in it and that works for you, then great. But it's not really how I saw her. What I saw is someone who had been living a life of some shallowness and who evolves over time and is actually, kind of a decent person and realizes that she doesn't want to be that girl. You know, she doesn't want to be the mean, bitchy cheerleader, and that this guy who you know, on one level shouldn't fit her in other words, I think she and Flash sort of grew apart. Flash was attracted to Mary Jane for, I think, kind of obvious reasons, not from any specific kind of
deep reasons.
But I think her attraction to Peter was legit. That it may have started with a little bit of, how dare he blow me off? That's hot. And I definitely think that was there. But I think, particularly once they really did start dating, I mean, I think she recognized that Gwen was a threat early on, again, almost before Peter did. I think she really made a legit go for it because she cared about him, because she thought he was this great guy, flawed, certainly. But she was pretty understanding of those flaws and really tried to make it work. I think, there's an element of she's kidding herself because, she recognized Gwen was a threat and yet didn't seem to recognize that the main reason Gwen was a threat was because Peter had a thing for her, not because Gwen had a thing for Peter. And it took her time to see that, and he kept, I don't think intentionally, I don't think he was trying to be mean, I don't think he was trying to be a bad boyfriend, but he kept sort of unintentionally sort of, how do I put this, like letting out the line and reeling her in and letting out the line and reeling her in, so that it sort of caught up to her. And then she winds up being kind of, very much messed up by it. I think. But I'm very fond of Liz. But I'm fond of Sally, so what do I know?
And I know we think that you pretty much covered Siren, so... With MJ was perfectly adapted from the series to the comic book, and I do mean... It seemed like it was perfectly adapted with the storyline that was originally in the original. It was the first 57, right, Don?
Her first appearance?
But I'm talking about the mystery leading up, oh, this good Mary Jane, the whole mystery.
You're talking about who is your date, my neighbor's aunt, that kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was around 57 that... and I'm just going off the top of my head because Don's more of the precise number there. But where did you see her role in the show, and what were your short-term plans for her character in the future?
Well, we saw, to me, we talked about the Green Goblin mystery. To me, the introduction of Mary Jane was one of the great classic introductions of all time. So, I didn't want to shortchange that. We wanted to play it out, which is why Mary Jane doesn't appear for, the first 5 7/8 episodes. We wanted to do her introduction justice. We wanted that classic line in there. I mean, I'm mind-boggled by this even now, but we actually got one network note saying to us that they thought that sounded too conceited on her part. And we had to sort of point out that, you know, this is one of the classic lines of all time, and you know, it's just, it's not an option to change it. And the good news is that, you know, we got that, you know, the guy got that, and we didn't have to change it. But yeah, there was that moment where you gotta be kidding me. So in terms of her role on the series, I mean, the way we saw it is that, in a sort of high school way, again, we're taking the MJ that we know from college and extrapolating back to high school. This is a girl who lives with her folks on Staten Island but is commuting to Manhattan to go to school here. Once she starts, at Midtown and that maybe she had kind of a rep at her old school, and so she's trying to get a fresh start, here at the new school. And so she's not going to get serious about anybody. You know, she wants to have a good time, but she's not going to let herself get serious about anybody. And we try to illustrate that even the one time she does get serious about someone, which is that, you know, she starts out dating Mark in season two because she thinks he's hot, basically. And then gets sort of caught off guard with how much she comes to care about him. But like, she won't let herself feel, you know, I think the thing with Peter is that right off the bat, she sees him as someone with potential. So she won't let herself get close to Pete in anything but a platonic way, because he's risky, and even Flash, you know, she sees something in Flash that maybe, you know, the audience didn't see until maybe a little later into season two, maybe not until Shoshan came into the picture. So she's sort of standoffish from Flash as well. Happy to go out on a date with him, happy to dance with Rand Robertson, happy to, you know, hang out with whoever, but she's not going to get serious with anyone. And so, you know, I think the thing with Mark is that she didn't think she was going to get serious with this guy, and then she did. So the idea is that you've got this girl who wants to be the party girl, wants to be the girl who doesn't get serious about anybody. What that really means is that, you know, she doesn't let anybody close. The first time she does, she actually falls for him. And so I think, you know, what we're trying to build for her in the same way that we're building for Gwen is sort of, all right, again, we know where MJ and Peter end up. We know this, you know. So I want them to start there. I mean, one of the things about the movie, which I kind of get, the Spider-Man movie, is, let's simplify things. Let's just have this one girl that he has been in love with from day one, you know, and so Mary Jane, first off, from my point of view in those movies, with the exception of the hair color and the fact that she calls him Tiger once a movie, is pretty much Gwen Stacy.
That's very true.
In personality, she's pretty much Gwen Stacy. And the funny thing for me in the third movie is that when they finally do introduce Gwen Stacy,
she's like Mary Jane.
She's like Mary Jane with blonde hair. And so, you know, I, for me, that just threw me a lot. It really did. With the additional bizarreness of it being is that Kirsten Dunst in real life is a blonde and Bryce Dallas Howard in real life is a redhead. So it was just sort of like, it was just like this weird sort of parallel, you know,
it's Sam
mirror
Raimi.
Mirror universe kind of thing, you know, for me. And I'm not even saying that in a critical vein. I'm just saying that, you know, it just caught me off guard a lot, you know, but for us doing what we were doing, you know, we really wanted, a Gwen Stacy who was the smart, person who got Peter, and we wanted MJ to be this girl who also got Peter, but in a different way, and wouldn't let herself get close. And, you know, in my mind, if you go down the road quite a bit, you know, the idea is that, you know, what ultimately is a catalyst that brings Pete and MJ together, and it's this tremendous loss. It's this huge, huge, tremendous loss that matures both of them tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
And so that meant to us that we had to make a Gwen and an MJ who fundamentally, as different as they were best friends. And so, you know, we only got two seasons. I would have loved to have explored that relationship further, but we tried to at least get that ball rolling. You know, I mean, I don't think we finished it. I don't think we got there. I don't think any of that stuff happened. I wasn't in a hurry. I mean, everyone kept saying, seems like every episode, oh, is this the one where Gwen's going to die? And, you know, we had no intention of killing Gwen, because our show is set in high school and Gwen doesn't die until late in Peter's college career. And we had no, and I want to reiterate this, we had no intention of killing Gwen off in our TV series. Because our TV series, even if we had done the five seasons I had hoped to do as opposed to the two that we got to do, the entire five seasons would have taken him from the beginning of his junior year to the end of his senior year. It would have been 2 years of real time, you know, from September of junior year through June of senior year. And we weren't killing Gwen off. Gwen doesn't die in high school. And, you know, it's easy for me to come out and say this, and I didn't want to come out and say this while we were still live, because, you know, if Gwen gets in danger, you don't want the audience to go, well, Greg's already said he's never going to kill her off, you know, the kind of thing. I don't want to remove all sense of danger from it, but it was kind of... you know,
common sense, really.
As I lurked here and there, kind of amazing to me how everyone kept going, oh, I thought she was going to die in this episode, you know, kind of thing. And I'm like, really? You really thought that? Really?
Seriously.
You know, because, you know, that was never our intent. We had very long-term plans, and they were pie-in-the-sky plans. I mean, I wasn't kidding myself that this was like, sure thing or anything like that. We weren't even sure if we would have a second season, and obviously we never did get a third. But, you know, long term, our hope for the series was, and I know I've said this in the press before, was that we'd do 65 episodes, five seasons of 13, all set in high school. And then my hope was is that we'd go and do some direct-to-DVDs where our audience had aged with us, and we could do the college years and deal with some of the more dramatic and serious and maybe a little PG-13 kind of stories that took place later in Peter's life. And that's really the way Spider-Man always was. You know, it wasn't like, and I don't say that as like, wow, look how revolutionary Greg Weisman was being. No, that's what Stan did. That's what Stan and Steve and Johnny did. You know, and the authors that followed them. You know, this wasn't me being a genius. This was me being, I hope, smart enough to see what was great about what these amazing creators did in the first place.
Okay. Wow. I've just left in awe in that whole statement, but to go on to probably the last, I think, important female character, and a somewhat beloved character, that's Black Cat. We were talking about her earlier. She's another character that seemed to be perfectly adapted from the comics. Her relationship with Spider-Man was strained by the end of the second season by the revelation of the identity of her father. What was your short-term plans for her, and what did you have her for the rest of the role of the series be?
Well, I mean, short-term you saw. Long-term, obviously, there was going to be conflict. I mean, you know, she was pissed. You know, and I think one of the things that mattered to us is that although we really liked the whole idea of her having this crush on Spider-Man, of course, she has no idea that Spider-Man's 16. She's not that old. She's only 19. but still she had no idea that she's dealing with a high school student. You know, she's just assuming that he's more or less around her age, give or take a year or two, you know.
Better, we thought she was probably around 24, 25, I think.
We sort of had it in our head that she was 19. In other words, that Betty was 20 and then she was 19, and that's sort of how we had it in our sort of mental breakdown of it. But, you know, I think the basic notion was that what we didn't want to do is turn her into a superhero. You know, she's a thief. And so we couldn't let them get too chummy. You know, that the attraction's all there, and we had a lot of fun with it, and we thought it was, I mean, I love the fact that in essence, Pete's real first kiss is with this girl Helen, who's really trying to distract him from the fact that she stole this jewel. and that he's so, you know, enraptured by it that she completely vanishes on him before he can recover, you know. But then obviously at the end of season two, she's now got a real reason to be pissed off at him. She doesn't know his backstory. All she knows is that he messed up something that was incredibly emotionally important to her. So we wanted to get a sense of her real feeling in there, because she's so flip and she's so sexy and she's so all these things that seem like, you know, they just roll off her and that kind of thing. We wanted to say, all right, but who's the person underneath that? Also, you know, we didn't want them to get too chummy too quick. And so what happens down the line again comes, it's that same notion of, all right, if you know where Black Cat and Pete end up, where did they start? It's a little easier for that because we kind of, you know, we know how they started. It was in the comics. And that relationship we were just kind of trying to duplicate. But I also wanted to pull her back from the notion of, you know, I didn't want her to be, you know, another superhero. I wanted her to be the thief, you know. She's not a killer. She's not one of the bad, bad guys or anything like that. But she's not one of the good guys either. And have her have that appeal, that dangerous appeal to Spider-Man, and have her be this temptation. So, you know, beyond that, you know, obviously, you know, their next encounter is not going to be quite as happy and pleasant because of what happened at the end of episode 25.
Okay. Well, Don's going to take the next question because, again, it's another one of those questions that will hurt me if he doesn't get to ask it.
speaking of blurring lines between good and evil, I had written reviews for the show before we started doing this podcast, and one of my personal things that I never kind of got around was the specific motivations of Eddie Brock. Your team had kind of built him up to be a good guy sort of in the beginning of the series, and as the show progressed, obviously his relationship with Peter grew more and more sour to the point where he's taking his anger out on who he thinks Peter cares for, and once he becomes a Venom, he seems to become an all-out bad guy. But how do you see his motivations? Do you think he went from being good to evil, or do you think it was more complex than that? I was kind of hoping for a little more clarification.
Well, I mean, you know, I think Eddie was a guy with problems from moment one. I mean, the way we put it is that Eddie's parents and Pete's parents both died in the same plane crash. And what that did for Pete is it made him obsessed with life. You know, in other words, that he became the guy who's determined to save you. You know, what it did for Eddie is it made him a little obsessed with death. Pete had Uncle Ben. Pete had Aunt May. Eddie didn't have anyone. You know, so we to hint at that. I mean, whether or not we were successful, it's not for me to say, but, you know, Eddie's the guy who's jumping on Electro, who's jumping on Lizard, who's doing, frankly, some pretty stupid stuff. I mean, one could look at it as heroic, but in hindsight, you wonder, well, is the motivation a heroic motivation, or is he a little bit in love with death? You know, is he a little bit... just a little, not a lot, but just a little bit nuts, you know? And we tried to show that this was a guy with a temper, you know, who has legit reasons to be pissed at Pete, but maybe overreacts a little bit, takes the betrayals a little more personally since they're clearly not directed at him, you know, and yet gets pissed off as if it were him. Is he the kind of guy who, you know, knows that Pete has, or thinks he knows that Pete has a thing for MJ, so he asks her out, you know, to try and hurt him? You know, Pete can be a jerk. He can, but you can't see Pete doing that. I'm going to ask out, you know, I'm pissed at such and such, so I'm going to ask out his girlfriend just to get to him, you know? You can't see Pete doing that. He's the kind of guy who does that, you know? And so we sort of tried to build through it, give him legitimate gripes as we went through that sort of pushed him closer and closer to the edge. And then ultimately, though, we team him up with this symbiote who clearly is influencing him. I mean, is having a physical and chemical influence, taking the somewhat unstable guy that Eddie is and twisting him even further beyond recognition almost. That was what we set out to do. Now, I gather from the tenor of your question that maybe we were a little less successful with that than maybe we were with MJ or whatever, but that was the idea, you know, that you've got a guy who's a little bit fascinated with death, who's a little less stable than he initially presents himself to be. The very first time you see him, he's in his element, everything's fine, there's no tension whatsoever, so he seems like this great guy, but the more you get to know him, the more you see the way he reacts. We tried to do a slow build with him until you get to the point where the symbiote takes over, and we really wanted to see the symbiote just twist this guy into knots so that by the time you get to the midway point in season two, he's so, in essence, in love with this symbiote that he needs the hate. It's not even about the legit reasons why he was mad at Pete in the first place. He needs the hate because he's addicted to the symbiote. And the hate is what keeps the symbiote loving him. And so it becomes about, you know, it, you know, in essence, it's another addiction metaphor. It's the abused, you know, it's the abused and the abuser where, you know, I'll do whatever it takes to keep this guy even though he's messing me up, or to keep this girl even though she's messing me up, to keep this symbiote even though she's messing me up. I'll do whatever it takes because I'm jonesing for her. And so, you know, that's what we tried to create with Eddie. Whether we were successful or not, it's not for me to say.
That's very interesting. And just real quick, I was curious. Did you design Eddie to have like romantic feelings towards Gwen? Because I was kind of getting that vibe throughout the series.
Nah, not so much. I mean, I think our thing with Eddie and Gwen was just that he liked Gwen. I mean, you know, again, Eddie was a year older than Pete and Gwen. So he was, two years older. You know, they're juniors in high school. He's a freshman in college, but, you know, they were in all the advanced science classes. And so he knew them both. And, you know, the idea is that prior to the beginning of our first episode, you know, they all went to high school together. You know, that is, Pete and Gwen's sophomore year was Eddie's senior year. And Eddie was sort of Pete's protector and probably Gwen's protector as well. And he thought Gwen was, you know, neat. And he kind of got that Gwen had a crush on Pete and thought that they'd make a cute couple and felt bad for her because Pete was such a moron, you know, about Gwen. That Pete was just blind to it. That he thought of Gwen as his, one of his two best friends, or one of his three best friends, if you count Eddie. But never kind of saw her for anything beyond that. And so I think, you know, when it becomes clear to him that Pete, you know, wasn't taking her to the dance, that, you know, he was like, well, I'll take you, you know. We'll have a good time. I think it was platonic on his point. I don't think he had a Joan for her, per se. But then when, you know, he gets all of Pete's memories via the symbiote, he's more intuitive than Pete is himself. The Venom, and this is important, it's not Eddie and it's not the symbiote, it's Venom, it's the combination, figures out that the girl that Pete's really in love with is Gwen. And so Gwen becomes, again, this is about the twisting of Eddie Brock. It's not about this is where Eddie Brock would have started. Because you're right, Eddie liked Gwen. I don't mean he liked her romantically, I just mean he liked her. But by the time the symbiote gets its hooks into Eddie, he's willing to kill Gwen to hurt Peter.
Okay. Well, I'm an idiot, so.
Well, it's not the first time, Don. But
well, you're not an idiot. I mean, if it didn't come across for you, then, you know, there's an area where we didn't quite get it done. You know, that's what we were trying to get across. If it worked, it worked. If it doesn't, then, you know, it didn't. You know, there's no rule that says you have to figure out everything that we had in mind.
Well, moving on, you know, one of the things of recent is the current status of the show. I know both me and Don, along with many, many fans, we're kind of frustrated because, to be honest, I don't think we've ever officially get any official confirmation because we really don't know who's in charge of the show anymore. You got Marvel saying it's Sony, Disney saying it's Sony, Sony saying it's Disney and Marvel, and I don't think anybody knows who's in charge of the show, and then they announce Ultimate Spider-Man. And I'm going to guess that, again, from the, I think, the first question that we asked you, that you didn't have any say in it. But maybe you could give us an update on the status of the show, if
well,
any.
Well, guys, I think you're kidding yourself. I mean, even the way you phrased the question, I mean, is phrased with such, I mean, calling it wishful thinking is an understatement. I mean, once they announce Ultimate Spider-Man, that's it. You know, I mean, there's no doubt that if they had wanted to, and I'm not blaming Sony, and I'm not blaming Marvel, and I'm not blaming Disney, I think it's fair to blame all three together. I don't know in what combination, but, you know, it's also fair to sort of blame a set of circumstances. You know, we started and were very successful on Kids WB, and then Kids WB shut down. You know, sold their shelf space to 4Kids and whatever. You know, it was just a bad luck set of circumstances. You know, negotiations between Sony and Marvel over the feature films influenced what happened on our show. Marvel's desire to have more control over their marquee character, you know, their single biggest character is certainly understandable. But like I said, I couldn't single out any one of those three big companies and say, I'll tell you where the fault lays. It lays with such and such. You know, it just doesn't work that way. It's a combination of factors. If you ask me who controls it, I can't really answer that either. My guess is that all the underlying rights for Spider-Man and television, as I understand it, went back to Marvel. Marvel is owned by Disney. But that the actual elements that went into our show, the specific designs, et cetera, are still the property of Sony. I don't know that. I'm guessing. But it doesn't change the fact that if they had really wanted to, these three companies could have gotten together and said, we want more spectacular. They could have. They didn't. they decided, no, you know, let's start fresh. No one from any of those three companies contacted me. I mean, period. Yeah. So it's not like I've gotten official word either, but if you think there's some chance here, you're just kidding yourself. Once they announce that they have started pre-production on a new Spider-Man series, they're not going to come back over a year later and say, hey, yeah, we also want more Spectacular. They're not going to do two series simultaneously. It's over. I'm not happy about it. I think I probably saw the writing on the wall before the fans did, only because, you know, because I wasn't being talked to at all, and so much time had passed and that kind of thing, I think it probably came as less of a shock to me than it came to the fans, which is not to say I had advance notice. I found out the same day everybody found out, but I probably was less shocked by it than some of the fans were. But, you know, it is what it is. And having said all that, that's not to say Ultimate may be a great series. You know, I remember when we were first announced, there was a lot of people, you know, when Spectacular was first announced, a lot of people in the chat rooms and on the boards and stuff saying, why are they doing this? Why are they rebooting? Why aren't they making more of the MTV shows? And or the only great Spider-Man show is the 90s show. Why aren't they making more of those? You know, they never finished Ultimate. I mean, they never finished Spider-Man Unlimited. They left that on a cliffhanger, you know. Why aren't they, you know, there were people saying the only decent Spider-Man show is Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. And someone else saying, no, the only decent Spider-Man show is the Bakshi show in the 60s. And you could almost tell how old the poster was by which show was there personal favorite. And I'm, on the one hand, incredibly gratified that people feel as strongly as they do about Spectacular. And I know that some of the people who talked trash about us before they saw any of it, I know we won some of them over. And I know there are others who we never win over. And I think we probably won more people over than we didn't if they gave us at least a fighting chance, you know. To, you know, watch the show, gave us a chance, I think, more people than not. But it'd be ridiculous for me, and I know nothing about the production of Ultimate Spider-Man. I'm not involved in any way, shape, or form. But, you know, there's no reason not to think that might not be a great Spider-Man show, too. And that, you know, a few years from now, there'll be a generation of kids for whom Ultimate Spider-Man is their personal Spider-Man show that that they look to. So, you know, the one great interpretation of Spider-Man. I don't know. I'm very proud of the 26 episodes we did. I very much wish we had a shot at making more. We had a lot more stories to tell. We had a lot more characters to introduce. We had a lot more to do with the characters we had already introduced. And it's a huge bummer to me that we only made 26. But I'm not going to let the fact that we didn't get to make more color what we did manage to achieve, which is that we did 26 episodes. If we had to end, I'm glad we ended at 26 and not at 13. I'm glad we got to finish out that Green Goblin story. I'm glad that we got to do what we did. I wish we'd gotten to do more, but, you know, it's the biz. Again, anyone who's sitting there still sort of holding out hope that Ultimate is just Spectacular with a different name, you know, that's just not true. It's just not the case. Spectacular is done.
And another reason why it's confusing is their description of the show is that it's basically going to, it's going to be a team up. That's what they said. It was going to be very much like the superhuman hero squad that's on Cartoon Network right now. So
I don't know that I agree with that interpretation of what their press releases have said at all. They've definitely indicated that they're going to have other heroes. If I'm being wry or rueful, say, you know, hey, this is what's different about our show. We're going to have other heroes. And I'm like, well, we would have done that too if you'd let us. You wouldn't let us, you know. The fact is that it was a different setup. It was Sony, you know, and Marvel who have I think it's fair to say, a edgy relationship. Whereas now it's Marvel within Marvel, so why not allow Spider-Man to team up with other heroes? But calling it Superhero Squad, I'm not knocking Superhero Squad, but the tone is vastly different, I'm sure, from what their intent is on Ultimate Spider-Man. And I don't, and like I said, I'm saying that as an outsider, but I think that sounds unfair to me. I mean, and I've seen all the press releases that they've submitted, so unless you've got other inside information that I don't know about, I don't think there's anything in the press release that suggests that the tone of Ultimate Spider-Man is going to mimic Superhero Squad, which is designed to be younger and designed to be a more comedic sort of tone. I don't see that at all in the press releases.
And I don't think both mean that, you know, Don can speak from experience from some of the things I've said when the press release first came out. I was actually one of the few people that was actually defending it, saying that we really don't know what Ultimate Spider-Man is going to be yet, so let's not come down on it. I'm just going off what I read with the press release, you know, I'm seeing, and that's just guessing. So, but with that being said, overall, that's it. I think closing, we both are huge fans. I know Don can maybe talk. You know, it's been one, in my mind, one of the best animated series, not just superhero series, but animated series period of the past 5 years. On television today. That's just my personal opinion. That's not, for me, that's not cherry picking it. I mean, when I look at some of the stuff that's on television today, I feel that Spectacular Spider-Man, story wise and animation wise, is one of the best out there. Don, do you have anything to add to that?
It was certainly better than I expected to be when it came out, and I could be more than happy to be talking to you and talking about the show on the podcast regularly. So thanks for giving a huge Spider fan something to enjoy watching, no matter how many episodes it has.
I just appreciate that, guys. I mean, you know, it means a lot to me and to all the many, many people who worked on the show, both, you know, like I said, Vic and the writers and the artists and the directors and the cast. You know, it was really, I'm not exaggerating, a huge labor of love for everyone involved. You know, we were a huge group of spider geeks on that show. I mean, just tremendous love for it. Josh Keaton, big time Spider-Man geek. You know, Peter McNichol, you know, Doc Ock was his favorite character growing up. You know, for all of us, it was just a real labor of love. You know, Vanessa Marshall tells a story that when she heard she got cast as Mary Jane Watson, she practically fainted. You know, that she was, you know, she's a huge Marvel Spider-Man geek also. I mean, also gorgeous. But you know, just sort of was so thrilled to be playing that character. And so many of us, Darren Norris, who played J. Jonah Jameson, it was like his dream to play J. Jonah. And that was true for so many people involved with the show, that the fact that it worked for you guys and for your audience, you know, nothing thrills us more, because, you know, that's what you set out to do. You never know. I mean, you know, ultimately what I do on any show I do is try and do something that I'd like, you know. But those of us on the show, we're trying to do something that, hey, if we were the audience, is what we'd want it to be. And then we just cross our fingers that the audience agrees. So, you know, if you guys agree, then I'm thrilled.
Well, we thank you for giving us some of your precious time to talk about Spectacular Spider-Man. It was an absolute joy. And we hope you, the fans, have enjoyed this labor of love that tonight has been to bring this special interview to you. Again, we want to thank Greg Bisonsky, you know, Greg XB on the boards on the Spider-Man Crawl Space, which, again, also got to thank our good friend Brad Douglas, who runs the Spider-Man Crawl Space. You know, without him, we wouldn't be doing this podcast, so we also got to thank him. So that's it for this very special interview of Greg Wiseman for the Spectacular Webs podcast. Until next time, Spider-Man fans, stay spectacular. And that was our interview with Greg Wiseman. We want to thank Greg for all the time he gave us. He gave us a lot more content than we anticipated we'd get. So we here at the Spectacular Webs podcast want to thank him very much. Of course, Greg has an upcoming project in Young Justice that he couldn't talk about, but hopefully you'll be able to find maybe some information about it at the San Diego Comic-Con. We don't know. Hopefully there will be some information there, so go check it out. Not that you shouldn't check out San Diego Comic-Con for other reasons, but maybe we'll get some information there. Of course, this is not the only show that me and Don do. Of course, Don has the Amazing Spider-Man Classics, which he does with John M. Wilson and Bertone Beetle. So check that out. It's usually also on the Spider-Man Crawl Space front page. And of course, I have several other podcasts. I have the Tokyo SOS podcast, the Godzilla podcast, which you can find at www.tokyosos.podomatic.com. I also have Hexcast, which you can find at www.hexcastpodcast.com. And I also do my Thomas's Prerogative, which is every Monday at www.animeshaft.com. Of course, also, I am involved in Walter Bowman's Capes and Feathers podcast, which you can find at www.tschamp.podomatic.com. You can find the forums of the show at www.thecomicforums.com. Just scroll down till you see Spectacular Webs. And you can find us on iTunes. Search us there and leave us reviews. You can also email the show with fan mail, hate mail, and any suggestions you have for the show at spectacularwebs@yahoo.com. So that's it for this very special episode of the Spectacular Webs podcast. Until next time, Spider-Man fans, stay spectacular.
Living on the edge, body cross, spinning webs, swinging from the highest ledge, he could leap above our heads. Looking up with no surprise, arriving in the speed of time. Spectacular, spectacular, Spider-Man. Spectacular, spectacular, Spider-Man. Spectacular.
What did you say your name was?
Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the USS Enterprise.
Which one of you is the captain?
Do we violate the treaty, Captain?
Red alert! All hands, battle station!
What are you scratching at?
Incorrect.
Can we just get down to it, please?
Prepare to attack. All hands, battle stations.
No!
Star Trek, monthly Mondays, available the second Monday of every month at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com.
Hey there, Thomas Mattis here, host of Thomas's Prerogative over at the Shaft Podcast. I'm here to announce the Shaft Podcast fun, exciting events that we're bringing to the MetroCon convention. What's Metricon, you may ask? Well, Metricon is the largest anime convention in Florida, and the Shaft Podcast is proud to bring 4 exciting panels that we will be bringing to Metricon, hosted by yours truly. Now, what are these panels? Well, let me tell you. First, on Friday at 5 p.m. in Room 19, you have Evolution in American Anime, where I will explain to you how American animation had a hand in the creation of anime, and how anime now in turn has come and influenced American animation. The next panel will be later that night at Room 13/14, a special event called Anime Theater Live, where we'll take a movie and riff on it. That's right, if you're a fan of Mystery Science Theater 3000 or riff tracks, this is the event for you, because we will be riffing on a movie. And you know what? If you say a good line that makes everybody laugh, we will give you a prize. Be anything from an anime DVD to manga to many other prizes we'll have with us. Our next event will take the very next day on Saturday in Room 18. It will be Thomas's Prerogative Live. Yes, I will be giving my unbiased opinion upon the state of the anime industry. Ladies and gentlemen, it's not going to be pretty. And then finally on Sunday, we will have another presentation, Anime and New Media. If you want to know where you can find your very favorite anime on the internet, or try to find where you can unite with fans on the internet as well, we'll tell you how to get there. So come down to Metricon from July 23rd to July 25th and join us in our 4 exciting panels that the Shaft Podcast presents. You can find Metricon by going to www.metroconventions.com, and you can also find the Shaft Podcast by going to www.animeshaft.com. So, until July, folks, peace!